right to drill for oil in the disputed waters. Northern Ireland's political leaders are pledging to defend their power-sharing government after a car bomb attack. Police say it was a miracle no one was killed in the explosion outside Newry Courthouse in County Down last night. Sport and Great Britain's women's curling team have been knocked out of the Winter Olympics. They were beaten 6-5 by the Canadian team. The men play later tonight. And Manchester United have beaten West Ham 3-0 in the Premier League. Wayne Rooney's 26th and 27th goals of the season did damage. Michael Owen came off the bench to get the third of the evening. That's the latest. I'm Chris Giles.
I only wanted to sing, and I can't even talk, but I'm awake. I can moan and I can just about walk, though my toes are falling out of my rotten old funeral shoes. For the sightless eyes that see, for the mummified memories of love that dead hearts cannot bear to lose, for the zombies who must sing the blues. As we stagger through the night time and the climbs higher, I hear the moans of a new nation, of a great zombie choir, and you've made it very clear that we're not welcome in your town. Oh, but we're going to stick around, irresistibly guided by your unmistakable incandescent beacon of sound. Song, you're going to have to choose. And such a swagger, but when things don't go your way, you start the zombie moan and stagger. And there's a rotten smell about the way you mummify your feelings and your views. And the faces of the dead that are pressed against your gate are like those voiceless longings with which you push against your fate. And you're going to have to face them and lose those things you cannot bear to lose, or else you've got to sing the zombie blues. We'll be right back.
Mike FM on 106.8 FM.
Good evening. You're listening to Spitting Feathers with me, Lee Rawlings, and we've also got co-presenter Tony Eccles in the studio as well. Say hello, Tony.
Hello.
Yeah, that sounded very, very mysterious. Well done. We've also got the wonderful Ashley Thorpe in the studio.
Good evening.
And Ashley is a filmmaker, award-winning filmmaker. Let's get that straight, okay? We want everybody listening and staying on for the next 2 hours to hear why you're an award-winning filmmaker of horror, okay? Atmospheric, very stylistic, incredible, interesting, textural filmmaking. We'll be hearing a lot about that in a moment. Ashley has brought some music in as well that has inspired the way that you possibly see the world.
Absolutely. I mean, they don't necessarily represent the stuff I listen to day in, day out. You'd be worried if it really was.
I don't really believe that.
But certainly the stuff that, you know, certainly inspired The Hairy Hands.
Mm. Which is what we'll be talking about a lot, hopefully over the next couple of hours, and why you do what you do and where it all came from. You've brought a track in which I think we should really head off into straight away, which is, well, tell us about it.
It's the theme for The Devil Rides Out. And apart from being fantastic for children's parties, and also a good one to play at the end of, you know, other parties when you want everyone to leave, it's the theme to the first horror film apparently I ever saw.
Apparently,
because I don't remember. I was very young. Apparently, Mum says I was about two. My dad used to work away from. My dad used to work away from home quite a lot, so my mum would keep me up late to keep her company.
Mm.
Oh, and my mum was a gothic horror nut.
Oh, right.
Still is, actually. And she used to sit and watch the Hammer movies.
Oh.
And one night, you know, she was feeling a bit lonely and a bit spooked out, so she brought me down, because I must have been a bit teary, and sat me down next to her. And apparently I sat there absolutely glued to this thing. Might have even chuckled a few times. And that's where it all began.
So you took it all in by osmosis.
I took it all in. I like to think I was just fascinated by the, you know, the colours, and the, because it was all quite, Hammer films are very vivid, that kind of technicolour. That's me being normal.
Yeah, but we now know that's not the case.
But that's not the case. And yes, the devil spoke to me that night, and I've been listening ever since.
We've got to all have an evil laugh on that one, I think. Should we give it a go? Yeah. Now that was it, wasn't it? There you are. Look,
that wasn't actually me, though.
Ashley Thorpe from Carrion Films. Now I've got to clear this up. Your name, Carrion Films. Okay. I said this over the phone the other day to somebody.
I know
you know what's coming,
say,
don't you?
Well.
And it sounded like Carry On Films. And the person who was listening to me was. Didn't get it for about 3 or 4 minutes.
Yeah.
Oh, you mean as in like vultures eating meat? And I went, yeah.
Yeah.
Not as in a camp 60s
that,
film.
The weird thing about that is while I was making Scarecrow with Mick Grierson, who's the chap that does all the music, at that point he was absolutely involved intrinsically in all the editing and things as well. It really was like a two-man production at that point. And we were sat there thinking, right, we could really do with a name for what we're doing, like a production company name. And I was trying to think of something quite cool. And we were both sat there and saying, well, it should be something that reflects something like Hammer. It should sound old-fashioned. It should sound quite dark and gothic without sounding really cheesy. But there's something quite playful. And in Scarecrow, certainly, there's a certain campness to it. Because it is so bombastic. And then we just looked at each other and just went, Carrion. Because it sounds a bit like Carry On, doesn't it? And then
you're
we thought,
wrong.
No, exactly. And it was done in that way. And the carry, obviously it's not Carry On Films, but it was done with that kind of playful idea that it was, it's a reference to the Carry On Films, and also the, you know, Hammer especially.
Well, that particular one, Scarecrow.
Yeah.
When you were accepting your award for,
yeah,
for this,
people get confused.
They call it Scarecrow.
Scarecrow.
Yeah. Tell us about what the award was for. I mean.
Scarecrow won the Media Innovation Award back in March, I think, last year. And it was for Best Independent Film and Video, which I was amazed by. I was absolutely amazed by. I kind of went along to that because it really was an excuse to...
Right, so you didn't actually know they'd won?
No, no. Oh, right, it's, okay. You always wonder with these things, don't you, whether you get given the golden ticket before you walk in. But we really didn't. I went along there with my fiancé and Ed, who'd had a cameo in it, and now he's kind of the main star in a lot of the things I make. And... It was an excuse just to go out and buy a tuxedo for a laugh. It really was. And we went along there thinking, well, this is nice, isn't it? This is quite swanky. Don't get to do this very often, do you? And it was. We went there almost out of a jokey kind of thing. It was just fun to be involved in it and just see, you know, a media event at work. And proof of the fact that we really didn't think we were going to win is that I sat there and was discussing with my friend Ed. And Ed was sat there with great confidence, and he'll hear this, so he'll be cringing now, hopefully, saying that, yeah, it's sorted. You're going to win it. You're going to win it. And I'm like, no. It's great that we were nominated. Nominated looks fantastic. We're not going to win it. He went, yeah, you'll win it, and, you know, I'll come up there with you. I'll accept it with you. And then when they started reading out the nominations, I looked round at him, and he was trying to strangle himself with his tie. He was getting really nervous. And then when they actually announced what it was, I was just shell-shocked. And I looked around at Ed as if in a pleading way, kind of held up my hand and go, you coming up then? And he just looked at me and said something I can't pretty much say on air. And that was it. And he just left me wander up there on my own. So, yeah genuinely, I had no idea.
Yeah, the speech was quite good, actually. It's quite amusing, wasn't it?
That's because I didn't start thinking about what I was going to say until about 5 minutes after I'd sat down. I had no idea. I just kind of went up there and I thought, I'm determined that I'm going to try and remember to thank everyone.
You
and I'm determined to embarrass Ed.
Yeah, you pointed at Ed.
I pointed at Ed.
And Ed, and you held that stance
absolutely.
For about, you know, 5 minutes.
For a good while, because I wanted all the heads in the audience to turn around and look at him.
Which they did.
God bless him. Yeah, and they did as well.
So you won an award. That's amazing. And you've been nominated for other awards. There was the, was it Rain Dance?
Yeah, that was quite mad. Scarecrow got picked up a Best Film Award thing at Horror UK as well. We got nominated for a couple of others. And then Screaming Skull came out. And, yeah, got nominated for Best UK Short Film at Raindance. And that was another crazy thing, to get invited up to London and to be all this sort of international talent there.
Yeah, but you'd already won an award by that point, so next time you went up and sat in the audience, were you thinking, right, here we go then, yeah, I'm going to win this?
In a weird way, it was the opposite. Yeah. It was in a weird way. You kind of have that feeling that maybe it shows in you that you've got one, so you don't need one. I don't know. I wanted
You're
it.
You're very modest.
I wanted it, but I honestly didn't think that I was going to get it, because the fascinating thing about that evening was that Screaming Skull was so very different from everything else that was shown there. Not necessarily better, but just so very different. Nothing else was anything like the techniques that are being used. Mm. The films that were shown at Raindance were very, very polished. They really were. Mm. They looked like kind of David Fincher level stuff. And, I was sat there with Ed, and you have our film up there, which they obviously were very happy with to give it the nomination. But I'm sat there sniggering next to Ed and thinking, yeah, we shot that bit in our garden, didn't we? So
some of the best films shot like that, though, aren't they? Let's face it, come on.
Yeah. But
okay, we'll talk about the techniques of your films in a minute, and then we'll go into dabbling with the legends that you play with as well. But tell us what your next track is that you got lined up.
From memory,
yeah.
I hope I'm right. I think it should be the complete end theme to Hairy Hands. If not, it could be Psycho.
Let's find out, shall we?
It's Hairy Hands. Thank you.
Okay, that's the theme to The Hairy Hands by Carrion Films. We've got Ashley Thorpe in the studio. You're listening to Spit and Feathers on Phonic FM, in case you're wondering what the hell we're going on about. Studio at phonic.fm if you want to email in and have a chat with us, or if you've got any questions for Ashley, okay? He is a horror aficionado, and we're just talking about the music that was playing to The Hairy Hands, your film. How did that come about? You know, who's the guy that creates these things, and how do you kind of work with him?
Well, it was composed and performed by Mick Grierson, who has done all the music in the films. And the way that we tend to work is that we'll discuss the film and its kind of theme before we start doing anything with the music. But I work in a funny kind of way. When I'm writing the script, I tend to do a poster to kind of sell the idea of it to myself, so that I can visualise it literally. Like, I've got the poster for the thing before I've even finished writing it. And with the music, I kind of drive Mick up the wall a bit, because I like to have the theme tune. I like to have the theme, so that while I'm sat there either finishing off the final script or while I'm animating, I can listen to just the theme of it. It doesn't have to be the whole score, but I can listen to the theme of it while I'm working. And with this particular one, it was at Mick's wedding, and I remember that we kind of promised to my fiance Sue and Mick's wife Maya. I think they were kind of hoping we weren't going to bugger off and start talking shop, but we eventually after quite a few drinks, were stood in the foyer of the venue, and Mick came up to me, pint of beer in hand, and said, "Look, I've got to ask you. I've only seen a little bit of music, a little bit of images and things from the film. So what are you imagining? What are you imagining for this one? You know, what's it going to be like?" I'm like, "Well, you know, it's got to be something kind of 60s, but it's got to have something contemporary about it, but in a late 70s, early 80s electronic kind of contemporary about it." And he looked interested. He went, "Yeah, okay. And he was waiting for my usual thing, which I do, which is this kind of ham and eggs approach, where I will literally just go, "It's something between that and that." He was waiting for it, and I just said, "Somewhere between the theme tune to Psycho and Behind the Wheel by Depeche Mode." And he just kind of looked at me, and then pint in hand, dropped to his knees, and just went, "Yeah, come on!" He just loved it, and he absolutely got where I was going with it.
I was going to say, that Tony, what do you reckon? That sounded just like the description, didn't it?
Yeah, totally. Yeah. As soon as it started, I was thinking, it's gone down the Psycho route, and then until you mentioned Behind the Wheel, I thought, oh yeah, exactly.
Yeah. It's got that nice hint of it, electronica thing about it. I mean, that obviously got refined as it goes on, and some of the other selections of music on here are pretty much the things that we use to kind of refine the atmosphere and the directional kind of textural styles and things that got altered with the soundtrack. So it started off with absolutely that. That's why that's kind of the end titles. It became more eerie and a bit more John Carpenter as it went on. I say that, but then it became a bit more like a cross between John Carpenter and the Ipcress file, actually. It got a bit more kind of refined.
So you're the ham and eggs approach again is coming.
It's the ham and eggs approach, yeah. It's just a bit of this and a bit of that, and yeah. Mm. That's kind of how the soundtracks are done. But I mean, I make it sound like it's, you know, it's easy, but Mick puts a lot of work into these things, and he does it from scratch, and he performs it all himself. All the sound mixing he does and the sound effects are done as well. In fact, he quite often does a lot of the voices and things in it, especially if we need somebody to scream.
So he's got a good screaming voice.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. He was, I mean, he's a professor at Goldsmiths now, teaching music technology, and does all sorts of extraordinary sort of neurological things to do with music. You know, helping deaf people see sound and things. It's
what, by screaming at them?
I think maybe.
Just, you know, you said he's got a good skill. So don't look at me like that, Tony.
No, I mean, the Screaming Skull, which is the second animation, there's a without ruining the ending, there is a big scream that, towards the end of the Screaming Skull.
There is in the trailer as well, isn't there? There's no
scream. Yeah, that scream at the end of the trailer.
That was a chilling piece of music. Not much music gets me, but I was watching it, and it was building, and I thought it's got to end in a minute with a crescendo of something, and it just ended with that kind of scream, which I couldn't quite work out whether it was a scream or music, which was really cleverly done.
Yeah, that was Mick. He did that. It's got a few gates on it, but it hasn't really got much in the way of filters. Mick sat there in a studio with a microphone and did that live.
And so does he do everything kind of via computers, or is it live recordings as well? The violins in that or not?
Bits of both. I mean, it's difficult, obviously, with the expense and the organisation to get full orchestras in. I'd love to know what he would do if he had the music, the money and the time to just go, right, I know you've composed it, because he actually did compose a piece of music for Screaming Skull, because it was written as a kind of a requiem. So he actually sat there, and it was funny seeing him actually write the notes out on scraps of paper, because I haven't seen him do that since he was at university. But he tends to do most of it via sort of sampled sounds, sort of sampled strings, but then he plays them.
Right.
But with certain things like drums or guitars, anything like that, or with sort of vocal effects and things, he'll quite often just do it himself. He can play everything from, you know, the banjo to the bouzouki.
There you are. That's got to be in the next film, isn't it? The bouzouki.
A bouzouki. Let's work it in. Let's do a film about the Minotaur.
Well, I wanted to ask also about your techniques of making film, because they are really interesting. I mean, Tony, have you seen any of the trailers or anything yet? You haven't seen it, have you? I managed to get to see a little bit, and it was very interesting, because you had some kind of rotoscoping, I think, was going on in one of them.
Yeah.
But also there was live animation, real people, almost stills being animated, and that probably what it is. And painting as well, and saturation, and all bleeding, and all kinds of interesting techniques. Why have you chosen this style of making, you know, horror movies?
I'd like to say it's because I'm really clever, but it's not. It really was something I kind of stumbled into. I always have a very clear idea of what it is that I want to make. I have a story that I want to tell, and I want to create the atmosphere, because I do a lot of illustration and painting. So what I tend to do with the animation is just this tug of war to try and find ways to which I can make the kind of still images that I make move. And it was just part of the process. The technique came out of necessity, really. It really did. And it started off as being lots of hand-painted backgrounds, because it's difficult to go off and find a, you know, 18th century tavern, for instance. So I thought, I'm going to have to paint it. I can take photographs of the house that moved, but I'm going to have to play around with it so it looks like a tavern. And then I would use... I would paint on it, and then with the actors, I could dress them up in costumes. But then... It's very jarring just to have a photographed person in front of a painted background, unless you're a, you know, Ralph McQuarrie or something. It's just not going to look right. It's going to look bizarre. So I started trying to make the paintings more photographic and trying to make the actors look more painted, and just used any kind of technique I could, whether it was collage or literally anything I can get my hands on to try and make it work in the way that I want to make it work, I use. So... something like Hairy Hands is nearly all digital. There's about 4 or 5 shots where there's some painting in there, but it's mainly digital. As you go back through Screaming Skull towards something like Scarecrow's about half painted. There's a lot of painted stuff in there, but all the actors, bar a few shots, are all photographed. So you have a photographed actor in say a photograph still of a coach that was probably taken at a museum against a painted moving background. So you've actually got 3 techniques in there all mixed up together, and then I play around with them and saturate them and muck about them in After Effects to try and bring them together so that the whole thing doesn't just look like layers sliding over each other. And then once you put things like a bit of a film grain on it to get rid of that digital sheen.
So you've got basically, you're, like you say, out of necessity.
Yeah.
If you, as a student filmmaker, and I've seen a lot of student films, and they often make the mistakes, myself included, I make films too, and you kind of look around and think, you're going to be really ambitious, and you want to film this, you want to film that, and then you realise you've got no lighting, you realise the sound is always a problem, because if you don't get right sound in a film, it makes the film just terrible, no matter how good the visuals are. So all these simple things are really hard to pull together. What you seem to have done is eliminated a lot of things, like you say, from necessity. necessity, and you've just brought in these other techniques to make it as easy as possible to tell the stories. But you've done it really well. You've done it in such a beautiful kind of way. You're already an artist, aren't you? Is that right?
Yeah.
You do painting anyway.
When I left university about 10 years ago. God, scary. And at first, I really did think, oh, I'm going to be a filmmaker. And then, you know, the reality comes crashing in and you realise how difficult it is to do that. If the technique has come from anywhere, like you say, trying to make life easier and kind of stripping away these inessential elements, it came from practicality, absolutely. Mm. And that I had done bits and pieces of work for the industry, like the BBC and things. And you just see how huge all the productions are. Everything's very difficult, and to get this cost this money, and the organisation of it, and it's just such hard work. Mm. And eventually I got to a point where I didn't really want to make things for other people or to necessarily impress other people. I just wanted to make these stories that I'd always liked since I was a kid. And then I just stripped away all the inessential elements and thought, right, well, if I do it this way, I could do this potentially without I can't do the music. I can do this on my own, pretty much. Mm. I mean, now I love having the group of people I've got around me now that help me do it, because we're all like-minded people. It's fantastic. But if I wanted to make an animation next week, I could do it. And most of that comes from the confidence that I have as a painter and an illustrator. I've had a few bits of work published in magazines and things, things like Head Press magazine. I've had a few things in there. Mm. And I had a couple of exhibitions of paintings here, there and everywhere and things. So I'm lucky I've got that to fall back on, because I never feel like I have the blank page. Mm. When I'm sitting down to write something, I hate the blank page, so I do a poster. And then I will sell the idea to myself, because I've got a poster, so I know what it looks like. All I've got to do is just kind of trace the words that are already waiting there. It's that whole thing about the potential waiting within the block of stone type of thing. I try to make something in the stone before I start, or else I am just sat like Jack Torrance in The Overlook, staring at the paper, hearing the tick-tock.
I think that's an absolute genius way of doing, writing a story or anything, getting yourself inspired. It's just draw a picture, or even probably get a collage of different pictures that you feel you'll be inspired by, and make a story from that as well.
Yeah, and with the music, it's kind of, I think it's a way of almost cheating yourself into believing you started.
Yeah.
I mean, I even do that with the paintings, to be honest. The paintings I do are very, very textural things. But that's, once again, about that fear of the blank. Instead of the blank page, it's the fear of the blank canvas. So before I start doing anything, I don't sit there and do my pencil marks and things. What I generally do, especially in acrylic, is that I'll sit there and I'll get a palette knife and I'll just gam all sorts of rubbish all over it, make it as rough and textured like an old, burlap or something, just make it rough. And then I've started. So I don't have to worry about how accurate the marks are, because there's mess there already, and I just work into it. Ah. And the textures can work for you. And I kind of work a similar way. I work a similar way with scripts. I don't necessarily start at the beginning. I just write the bit that I'm most excited about and work backwards. Sometimes I quite often write my endings first and just work.
Tony, you're nodding. You're a writer. Is that the way that you work?
Well, I mean, obviously, I don't do a poster because I'm not artistic like yourself in that way. I build up an atmosphere. I have an atmosphere, so I write a paragraph first of key elements, and it's not a beginning or an ending. It's somewhere in the middle, and my mind automatically slots it somewhere, so I'm able to write the connecting pages, and then the character comes along, and it depends on the length of the actual story itself. A 12-page story, you don't have a lot of room to develop a character, but you've got a lot of atmosphere, so you can contain the whole story in that. But it's just interesting what you're saying about, this thing about not having a blank page. For me, I don't see the pages being blank. That's just the medium, but it's the atmosphere I have to start off with. And what I do is I reminisce. I mean, I've been in old haunted houses, and I've done investigations and, try to resolve what people have seen or what they've heard or what they've photographed or what they've recorded. And I go through and I spend hours trying to understand what this electronic voice recording is supposed to be about, or video footage, and I'm thinking I'm either wasting my time or there's something here. And then you get your interesting elements where you've got this strange light, and that in itself just brings back these memories about what it was like to be there. And then I've got this sort of atmosphere as well. I mean, I have been scared on a number of occasions, not all the time, I like to be scared, and I like to scare myself, and it's very hard to do nowadays.
But you were saying earlier that you you use music a lot.
Yes.
You use that to actually evoke that sense of perhaps dread in those places.
I can't play anything lively. You know, I can't play any pop music, or I wouldn't anyway, but I can't play any metal, or I can't play... It has to be either... And depending on what scene I'm writing, it tends to be, like, the theme from The Thing, for example, or Halloween, or something like that, to get me into the mood. Or if I'm writing something that's more backgroundy stuff, I'll put on a piece of classical music. I mean, the thing is, I mean, the recent Nicholas Hooper scores for Harry Potter... I love, they just bring me in, just drag me into this other world. Okay, J.K. Rowling's not a brilliant writer, but the world, the fantastic world that she's created is brilliant. Totally.
World.
It's a multi-layered world in that sense, and I love that. And the music just reflects that brilliantly. So, like yourself, I get hooked.
Yeah, I mean, I listen to a lot of music when I write. In fact, I think the next track was probably one I listened to a lot.
Good, nice link, yeah. Great link.
That almost sounded scripted, didn't it?
Apart from that, I missed a cue, but never mind. You were talking about a palette knife earlier, weren't you?
Mm.
Yeah, could you do anything with a palette knife to this music? Okay, so there you are. That was Psycho. Who composed that? Anybody know?
Bernard Herrmann.
Thank you very much. That's Ashley Thorpe that just spoke there. He is with Carrion Films. He is a horror filmmaker, award-winning, may I add, here right now on Phonic FM for your pleasure. We've also got Tony Eccles, obviously our supernatural expert and writer as well, we've discovered tonight. Well, you have, listeners. We're going to talk about the hairy hands, and I'm going to pass you over to Tony, right?
Yes. Hello. Hi. We've talked about the sort of technical side of filmmaking, and something I'm really intrigued by, but I think a lot of people want to know about what. I've got a great list of the stories you're interested in, but tell me more about what Hairy Hands is actually about.
It's about a stretch of road on Dartmoor, the B3212, which pretty much stretches straight across Dartmoor, two bridges way, and it's a stretch of road that's supposed to be haunted by a pair of disembodied spectral hands. that appear out of nowhere and grab the steering wheel of the car or the handlebars of the bike, and pretty much try to wrestle you off the road. Now, there's it was a story that kind of came to notoriety, I think, in about the 1920s. Cause I think there was a legend has it that there was a prison warden that was supposed to have died on that stretch of road, and it kind of caught the nation's interest during that period and kind of swept up and down the nation. But like any of the these legends now, I've been amazed how many people haven't heard of this now. I mean, okay, yeah, the 1920s, it's, you know, like talking about it like it was yesterday. But because I heard this story so much when I was young, and I suppose because we've grown up in this area, I took it for granted that everybody knew it. And people don't know it. Mm. And one of the fascinating things that I found when I started researching it is all these different, I mean, like any type of folklore, how diverse a lot of the different versions of the legend are. Yeah. And it's just sort of, it takes root in a culture and it starts growing and the roots start changing direction, and a lot of people thought it was, you know, they were the hands of a murderer, that there were links where it was supposed to be in the hands that were, of a tin miner that, who either died in an accident or he was betrayed, and you had all those elements. And because of the sort of thing that I was doing, I kind of left that as a bridging device, and just had a kind of a an amicus-style thriller, that scream and scream again sort of atmospheric type of thing going on within that device, because I realised that it was going to be very difficult to take that sort of legend and really do all the different threads of it justice. Because if I came out and just said, yep, it was the hands of the murderer, you know, people go, oh, rubbish, no, it was a tin miner. So I'd leave it open, because, you know, nobody knows. And the thing that's exciting about that, the core things that make that story scary, are just the idea that you're driving along Dartmoor, which is pitch black at night time. There's nothing there. There's no lights to guide you. That's it. It's black.
Well, you should always have a mobile phone with you when you're driving through, isn't that right, Lee?
I wouldn't know.
But saying that, when we went up to film a lot of the stuff on Dartmoor, you watch your signal drop away.
Totally.
As you get across Dartmoor, you are completely isolated. So that's the core fear of it. You're isolated in the middle of nowhere. Anything happens, you're stuffed, basically.
Typical basis of any horror film, isn't
exactly.
it?
Exactly. You've left the campsite. Mm. You've gone out to investigate the noise in the woods.
Yeah.
And you can't remember the way back. You've had it, basically. And I wanted to take this, the idea about being isolated, and also mix it with this idea that it's a frightening idea to be in a car and to fear that there's something else in the car.
Mm.
It's an old classic urban legend, you know, the woman that drives away from the petrol station and the guy's waving because there's a murderer in the back seat and she doesn't know. That's one fear, but I mean, you get everyday fears as well, you know people driving along and see in the mirror a spider coming down from the ceiling behind them, or a wasp flies in, or a hornet or something. Mm. When you're driving, it's quite frightening. So I just wanted to take those basic core elements of what was frightening, mix it with something very local and something very neglected, and just see what kind of came out of it.
Yeah, can I just ask about the scarecrow? I don't want to give obviously plots away or anything like that. There is a highwayman in the film.
Yeah.
Where does that come? How much can you tell us without giving too much away about the film? What's that about?
That's not primarily linked to a local myth as such. That was a character that I just thought was sorely neglected from, I guess, a lot of popular fiction.
Mm.
Because I was a massive fan of the Dick Turpin show, the Richard Carpenter one, when I was little. I had a t-shirt and everything. And I always just wondered why more people didn't make films about highwaymen. So I took the idea of a highwayman, and I thought I'd like to make it a ghost story. Because I always really liked the Alfred Noyes poem, The Highwayman. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to just try and blend the two. and just make a supernatural highwayman thing. Cause it's like, well, I like that and I like that. It's back to ham and eggs again, isn't it? Mm. A bit of a ghost story, bit of a highwayman. And and just fuse those two things together.
Can I just tell you something? It'll be of no interest to you because you've made the film and won an award with it, but that was my idea.
Oh, God, you always do.
Sorry.
It's just that a long time ago, about 15 years ago, I wanted to do a horror film about a highwayman on Dartmoor who was a ghost, but he travelled along the ley lines. You see, and that would be his downfall eventually. But
I'll race you to a sequel.
Oh right, okay, right. I'll sell him a pitch. There's more to it than that.
Buy the rights off you first, though.
Yeah,
I love
yeah.
the what?
You have got to buy the rights off him.
Oh, I thought you said I'll have the lights off him first, as in this car.
That sounds really dodgy.
I saw that.
Yeah. I had this idea years ago, and it was inspired by a pub up on Dartmoor, which you probably know, the Highwayman Inn.
The funny thing is that I haven't been there.
Oh, really?
I've been told about it a few times, and each time I've always thought, yeah, we've got to go there. But I still haven't.
Yeah, go there before it, changes hands.
And becomes something stupid.
Yeah, yeah. It's an amazing place. And they're amazing people as well. Yeah. They're worth doing a film about, just about the people who run it. Because they're, I can't say they're bonkers and nuts, because that's not right. But they are.
But in an affectionate way.
Yeah, no, I love them a lot. And I've known them for like nearly 20 years. But it's a great, great pub to go up to, especially if you're feeling out of inspiration, which you plainly are not, because I'm just looking at a list here of stuff that you're thinking of making. Okay, so let's just go down the list here. You've done The Heavy Hands, completed 2009. Spring Hill Jack is in pre-production. We'll talk about that in a minute. The Lambton Worm, Night of the Kraken, or Kraken, Bone Coach, which sounds like the Phantom Coach to me, I hope.
Campton Castle.
Oh, right, okay. Demon Huntsman, The Pendle Witches, Borley Rectory, which is something, you know a lot about, don't you, Tony? And Hell Tour feature. It says feature.
It now is. It would be.
A feature is
it
a
will be.
A full length movie.
It will be, yeah.
How long do you reckon it will be before you do a full length movie?
25 years. I've got to write it first. I've been assembling the stories for it.
Yeah.
The funny thing about Hell Tour actually is that it's my cheater's way of doing a feature film, because it's actually going to be one of those old portmanteau horror films, like the Amicus production things, like Beyond the Grave, those sorts of animals. And but basically, it's going to be based around Dartmoor legends. It's going to be the Amicus movie for and about Dartmoor, and just kind of rejoicing in the richness of these stories down there. But Hairy Hands originally was going to be the bridging story, and I'd started writing Hell Tour, and the Hairy Hands bit was the first bit that I wrote, because that was going to be the main character. This in Hairy Hands was just going to be this character that, you know, ends up becoming one of these ghosts. And and then suddenly, when the possibility of money came up to make another animation, and they wanted a script fast, I pretty much just kind of went and just picked Hairy Hands up out of the script, worked on it and developed it a bit, and it became its own separate entity. So it may yet still be the bridging story, because I quite like the idea that, you know, the character takes refuge in a place, probably somewhere like the Warren Inn, because it's just so much in the heart of it.
No, because you mentioned the Warren House Inn was actually featured in the film, wasn't it?
Briefly.
Now, was it actually the actual was it the actual pub itself, or did you, I mean, was it spooky enough in an atmosphere inside that pub, or did you have to recreate something else for the interior?
In the Hairy Hands?
Yeah.
It didn't actually appear in the Hairy Hands. It appeared, you briefly see it, I think, in a trailer, because I think originally I wanted him to stop at the Warren Inn Hell Tour, but because he wanted to really streamline the narrative of Hairy Hands, we don't really even give him time to stop. He's literally just bombing across Dartmoor, and the only place he stops is at a garage to get some more fuel, and meets a very strange carriage attendant.
So we'll come back to the inn at some point.
Yeah.
It's just that Dartmoor is such a fascinating landscape. It's not just the legends, but it's where the legends come from. Hairy Hands is quite evocative of werewolf or lycanthropy, and the fact that wolves were actually no longer roaming around the countryside in the 19th century. I mean, that sort of legend stopped then. But you still have, and Hairy Hands is more or less an early 20th century phenomenon. You don't have 21st century reports of them. It's more like the first couple of decades, isn't it?
Yeah.
From when, you know, you have this the doctor dying on his bike, his daughter surviving, you've got other people in their cars. And I'm wondering if that sort of story might be like a comment on the idea of people's fear of technology, because cars were still sort of new thing at that time. And it's this thing of, I mean, the stories always seem to draw on our basic fears, and I'm not always sure. I mean, it's not always the case. I think sometimes it's just good storytelling. But I wonder with your particular stories whether you're going to be touching on any of these links at all, or whether you don't think they're relevant in that sense.
No, I think that there are some relevant things to it. I do find it really curious that certain certain eras certainly seem to fall in love with certain types of tales. Mm. I mean, a very modern phenomenon nowadays is the fact that if you look at hauntings, that the orbs. I mean, orbs. What's that all about?
Yeah,
I mean,
we've talked about this before.
Yeah, it's quite
dust.
Yeah, exactly, and it's but people believe it because people have been so exposed to the traditional types of ghosts that they find them hokey, but they don't find orbs hokey because they're abstract.
Mm.
So that's cool. We can take that. That's fine.
Even though in old stories, the haunted houses are always described as being dusty,
yeah,
and damp and dirty.
But the weird thing is that you'll have somebody who will say like, "Oh, this place is haunted by a highwayman," and look, there's an orb. It's the highwayman, isn't it? And it's just like.
It's a great label.
Really?
Isn't it?
What? So after 300 years of appearing in that garb, he decided, "Oh, I can't be bothered with that. I'm going to appear as a will-o'-the-wisp." But, I mean, I don't really buy that. But I do think that the different eras are fascinated by certain tales, and they do reflect something about the era in which they've been told. Definitely.
Yeah, I've seen orbs. Yeah, definitely.
That sounds dodgy, isn't it?
Yeah, loads of them. I've got filmic evidence and everything on YouTube. You can go and watch it later.
Waste of money.
Let's just play this for a second. So what was that theme tune all about then, Ashley?
That was the theme tune to The Persuaders by John Barry again.
John Barry's a genius, isn't
absolutely.
He?
Absolutely. And that was another one that inspired some of the Hairy Hands music.
Oh, really?
Because I don't know why, because all the films I've done have been sort of period pieces in some way. Mm. And I was determined to do a contemporary one, but not quite. So I wanted to have this kind of 60s edge to it in the way that it looked, but at the same time, the music to reflect the 60s edge of it, and the mysterious old-fashioned sort of armchair thriller
espionage almost,
yeah, kind of feel about
almost,
it
he's running away from something, because I still haven't seen him in the film, obviously.
He's basically stolen some money,
right, so he's on the run. So you've almost I'm trying to think of the wonderful film 39 Steps is a film that I enjoyed a lot as well, and that had a kind of a theme of somebody running across moors in Scotland being chased by strange enemies from different,
yeah. He suspects he's being chased in the hairy hands, so he's on the run, but then he doesn't realise that you know, his greatest threat is actually in the car with him.
Oh yes, that's what I wanted. Okay, that's going to make me want to go back right now. And in fact, you can do as well. If you go to Carrion Films on the web, you can download any of their films for a mere $2.99. Is that
$2.99? Yeah, we got the Vampire, which is the first one, the sort of experiment one. We got Scarecrow and Screaming Skulls up there. Okay. Harry Hans isn't up there yet because it's just about to start the festival run, and there's a few festivals that get quite snotty about the fact that if you're selling them or showing them in their entirety online, some of them don't like that. So,
Fair enough. Which festivals are coming up then that it'll be shown at? Do you know?
We're going through them at the moment. It's in consideration at the Chicago Horror Festival.
Oh, cool.
That's the first one.
Do you get to go over there?
Well, probably not.
Can work on it, yes. Actually.
Jonas Stewart.
Yes, that's right. Of the Media Centre, right here.
I'm representing the Phoenix. Yeah. No,
sure
I don't
find
know.
Some money. Yeah, anybody listening who wants to fund Ashley to to go over to America and see his film being screamed in.
I'll put a tin on the bar.
Well, at least you'll get a big audience, though. People will get to give you feedback. Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the weirdest things that happened with Scarecrow and Screaming Skull last year was that, because I befriended a journalist for Fangoria magazine called Chris Alexander, who just went absolutely crazy about these films that, you know, made locally and made for very little money, and he adores them. And he really pushed them last year, and he managed to help get them shown at the Fangoria Weekend of Horrors, which was in New York.
Wow.
And there were people like Dario Argento there, and wow, Guillermo del Toro, and all these sorts of things. Well, I don't know, probably not. They probably went out for a fag break when my stuff came on. It was at part of that event, and so it's extraordinary that, you know, the kind of people end up seeing the films, and some of it was shot in the garden.
They are quite esoteric.
Don't give your secrets away.
No, I'm not
really
going to say what garden.
Please don't.
They are very esoteric. They are very interesting on it, and almost an arty. They're a bit of an art piece, really. Unusual in the sense that they don't flow like a normal film does. So do you think people could handle a full hour and a half of this style of filming?
I think so. I mean, I don't think that... I tried to make sure that the narratives in them were quite direct and straightforward, and that would definitely follow through with a feature, because there'd be a bridging story, but each of the stories would be very easy to follow. Because, like you say, I think that the rotoscoping technique is a little bit... It can be distracting. Some people get absolutely lost in it, and they love it, and other people do find it quite alien, which in some ways can be good, sometimes bad. On the good side, it can make it feel a little bit... expressionistic and make it even more eerie. But I like the rotoscoping thing, because one I noticed with the playlist that one of the films actually that did inspire a lot of the Scarecrow stuff, especially with him galloping, I endlessly watched the Ring Rider stuff in Ralph Bakshi's Lord of the Rings, because I love that mixture. I love the mixture of reality, like the live-action film stuff, with the fantasy, the animated stuff. Because I think that those things work really well in films that are talking about legends anyway, which are ultimately about the play between fact and fiction. I think rotoscope, personally, I find it captures that. And I found it very evocative in Lord of the Rings for that reason. I mean, that was feature length.
It was. I think I thought I was the only one, actually, who had seen that film as a kid and really enjoyed it for what it was. Mm. And everybody said, oh, you know, he ran out of money and he didn't have a lot of money, so he had to do it like this. And it's not proper animation.
I didn't see that as important.
I found it made that the Ring Riders, especially, they're supposed to live between worlds. I found that it made them even more frightening as a kid because I kept looking at them and thinking.
You didn't know where that other world was anyway. It looked
death-like. Alien.
Yeah, alien. It was just totally.
They just looked so dreadful compared to it's very rare that the hobbits in the film were ever. They weren't rotoscoped that much. They obviously paid much more attention to making sure they continued to do them as cell animation. Mm-hmm. Whereas at things like the orcs and the villains of the piece, they used rotoscoping a lot. And you know, to hell if it was done to save money.
It worked aesthetically.
I think.
Obviously, the scene where the hobbits are underneath the tree root, and you've got the ring wraith
awesome
just behind.
Sequence.
I mean, it's so good, that sequence, that obviously Peter Jackson lifted it entirely for his film.
But ironically, I don't think in the Peter Jackson one that bit is as scary as it is in the animated one.
No, it's not. Isn't that strange?
Yeah.
Even with all the worms coming out. And also, outside the Prancing Pony, I was a bit disappointed with Peter.